This is IPR News Radio. I'm David Castleman. Good afternoon. Nearly 50 years ago, North Vietnamese and Viet Cong soldiers launched an offensive that changed the course of the Vietnam War. The Tet Offensive shocked Americans. It showed them that the enemy was far more capable than they'd thought. Fierce fighting erupted across South Vietnam, including in an area just south of the Demilitarized Zone, north of the city of Hue. This is the setting of Doug Stanton's new book. It's called The Odyssey of Echo Company, the 1968 Tet Offensive, and the epic battle to survive the Vietnam War. And it tells the true story of one Army paratrooper and his platoon. Doug Stanton is the author of three books, among those Horse Soldiers and In Harm's Way. And he's, of course, co-founder of the National Writer Series here in Traverse City. Doug Stanton, it's great to have you in.
Thank you so much.
You can call in with your question or comment for Doug. The number is 800-681-5929. Doug, I want to start with the reading from your new book. It's from the beginning of the book, from what you call the invocation. Could you set the stage for us and then read the passage?
Sure. Thank you, David. It's January 31st, 1968. It's nighttime. Stan Parker and his group of 19-year-old comrades are from around the country. They've ended up in Vietnam. They've settled in a new base camp, which I visited with Stan Parker, a knob of a hill surrounded by woods. They bed down for the night, and that happens to be the night that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong launch their largest offensive of the war. These guys are unprepared. They're highly trained, but they don't know this is coming. And so I began the book with something I called an invocation, which tries to set the scene for what follows. January 31st, 1968, Landing Zone Jane, Northern I Corps, near Hai Lang, South Vietnam. It's 4 a.m. when they attack. Stan lifts himself up from the puddle, whiskered face dripping wet. He's been sleeping in cold water, trying to pull an imaginary blanket over his aching shoulders, water filling his nose, his ears. He hears whistles, shrill whistles, like a referee's, the same sound he'd heard in high school when he was about to pin a wrestling opponent. But now soldiers are running past him. What's happening? He feels a blow to the head, and he's knocked dizzy. He tries standing, but he can't move. He can't move. His cold bed, made of muddy water, has left him numb. He's scared. He's so utterly embarrassed and ashamed about this. Who's watching, he wonders. Who will know I can't move? He sees an enemy soldier running in his direction, a sweaty face, lit by flashes as it gallops toward him. Coming into focus, Stan freezes. He sees the soldier's silver bayonet riding toward him, the sharp point swinging back and forth in the damp air, hunting him. When the soldier pitches forward and the bayonet falls past Stan's face, just missing, the enemy soldier crashes down on Stan. He looks up and sees another soldier, an American, an older seasoned trooper, jerking his own bayonet from the attacking soldier's back. The trooper yells, urging him to get up. The dead soldier is dressed in khaki pants and shirt, the uniform of the North Vietnamese Army. He's young, maybe Stan's age, 19 or 20. Stan's never been this close to or touched a dead person before, except when he said goodbye to his mother at her funeral a few months back. He pushes the body away and jumps up, and he starts running. He runs towards the concertina wire at the rim of the hill where the landing zone is situated. Stan knows the 101st Airborne soldiers have to hold the wire. But how? Artillery is blasting now, long shells crunching over Stan's head, sailing into the dark. The ground is shaking. Illumination flares throw gray shadows against the trees, making enormous apparitions that crawl through the branches, limb to limb. Stan looks down the hill and sees hundreds of NVA soldiers pouring up the scrubby draw at him. He's afraid of dying. He drops to one knee and starts firing his M16, and then he sees something even more amazing. The enemy soldiers start pole vaulting over the wire.
Thank you. That's Doug Stanton reading from his new book, The Odyssey of Echo Company. It's about a platoon of American paratroopers during the Tet Offensive of the Vietnam War in 1968. So this is day one of the Tet Offensive. Stan Parker was 19 years old in the 101st Airborne Division. Who was this person? Who is Stan Parker, or who was he at this point?
Stan Parker is your uncle. He's your grandfather. He's your brother. He's a guy from Gary, Indiana, the son of an iron worker who traveled around the country to dozens of cities growing up in small towns everywhere. And he fetches up in his teenage years in Gary, where his dad works for Bethlehem Steel. He is the son of World War II. His father was a bomber in World War II, as many of these guys were in the platoon. He is a young man who goes to the diner on the weekends and drinks milkshakes and drives around thinking about what the world's going to hold for him. World War II is over. The Cold War is on. There are three channels. And what he knows is what his father tells him is that if he gets called, he should probably go.
And Stan volunteers for the Army in 1967, right after graduation. What has Stan gotten himself into? What had he gotten himself into at that point?
He thought he'd gotten himself into the greatest adventure he could imagine. He wanted to be a screaming eagle. He wanted to be a part of that cadre of a tradition of paratroopers who jumped during World War II into Normandy. That's what he wanted more than anything. And to become a member of the 101st, a Screaming Eagle, is no small feat. And so these guys are highly trained, and they volunteer for this dangerous mission.
What was the fighting like for Stan over the next few months? What does he face?
It's nonstop. I mean, what he thinks he's going into is what he can only really imagine is some type of battle, you know, some type of symmetrical. He knows it's not going to be front lines and like World War II. He knows that their job is to attack and to kill people and to create a body count. But yet, he's not prepared for the intimacy of this fighting. And the other sense of it, that it's nonstop. Like, it's a 360-degree experience 24 hours a day. You can go to the rear, but when you're up front on the line, it's a never-ending battle to both day and night. You're either walking during the day or you're on ambush at night.
Let's talk about the larger context of the war. What was the state of the war when Stan arrives in Vietnam? And he arrives in December 1967.
The war is really ginned up. He's part of the one of the largest movements of the 101st, some 10,000 troops over there to really escalate the war. General Westmoreland has assured us all that there is some light at the end of the tunnel, that we have them on the run. And then within weeks or months, the Tet Offensive happens. And so throughout the country, you have on this evening, which I just read about, you have all these little explosions going on throughout the country. What the North Vietnamese government is hoping for is some type of uprising within South Vietnam, that suddenly see for the indigenous people living there that somehow they will join the fight and throw off the American aggressor. And that didn't happen. And we, the American forces, ended up crushing the Viet Cong and decimating them essentially and really pushing back the North Vietnamese. But from a psychological perspective, it turned the tide of the war, and it made Americans wake up and think, how could we have been so close to victory and yet here this just happened?
The offensive happens all across the South, from right. Cities and villages and towns, all the way from, you know, the dividing line between the North and the South, all the way down to Saigon and in the Mekong Delta in the southwest of the country. How did the North Vietnamese plan this?
Very carefully and very patiently, and they'd had a long time to think about doing such things by moving soldiers and material down the Ho Chi Minh Trail from the north, using a tunnel system and a concealed trail system. Remember, not everyone has a uniform. So if you're a cab driver in Saigon and you get the signal that the offensive is going to happen tonight. You step out of your cab and you pick up a weapon that's been stored somewhere. I mean, it is an amazing feat of coordination among their administration to have pulled this off. It was a shocker. If you go on YouTube and look at the footage of this attack on the embassy in Saigon, it's it's iconic.
And where is Stan? Stan is in the northern part of the southern Stan part of South Vietnam.
Yeah, so Stan is far north of Saigon in I Corps. He's really much closer to the DMZ, which would be the dividing line between the north and south portions of Vietnam. And their job is to interdict or stop anyone coming over the DMZ that might launch this attack. What they end up doing is interdicting enemy fighters who are coming down to join the fight. So their job as a reconnaissance platoon is to be the eyes and ears of other companies and to radio back, we've spotted somebody here. You guys should come over with all of your troops, and there's a battle to be had.
Doug Stanton's new book is called The Odyssey of Echo Company, the 1968 Tet Offensive, and the Epic Battle to Survive the Vietnam War. And you're listening to a live call-in program with Doug on IPR News Radio. You can call in with your question or comment. The number is 800-681-5929. 800-681-5929. We'd love to hear from you. What were some of the objectives of the unit at this time? Or maybe a better question is, what are they trying to accomplish in their fighting at this point? I guess I'm not putting it very, very right, but what are these battles trying to accomplish? What are they trying to do?
I mean, ultimately in the strategic sense, each of these battles is meant to break the will of the enemy by killing more of them, so many of them that they can't be replaced. And that you can just imagine the spiritual geometry of that equation, what that would do to you as a young man or even woman, because women did serve. But each firefight, each skirmish, each ambush is about destruction. And the body count becomes a marker. So we're not taking property. We're not taking ground. We're trying to take the will of the enemy to fight. It's a very different paradigm. So this is what Stan Parker from Gary, Indiana, who sat around the dinner table with his World War II era father, is thrust into. And it's really what a generation was thrust into. And so when they come home, this is a hard war to explain. I don't think this is this is not an angry book. The book ends with a smile in a way. Maybe won't give it away, but, I think that Vietnam is America's greatest unfinished narrative. And I think it's a national tragedy that we don't know how to talk about this war. I mean, we can talk about World War II. I've written about that in an enormous way. And we talk about heroes, humble heroes, heroes who don't want recognition. When we talk about Korea, we say that's the forgotten war of those poor guys. We have a handle on everything. We can talk about the Civil War. We can talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, which I've written about too. But yet, we have done ourselves a huge disservice kind of creatively, socially, psychically as a country not to really come face to face with Vietnam. Because just imagine, David, so just take the most important year of your life, whatever it is. Any of us listening, what's the most important thing that ever happened to you? And then tomorrow morning you wake up and you can't remember any of it. And you know that you can't remember it. And then you also know that everyone you meet doesn't even want to hear you say that you can't remember any of it. It's a completely it amputates a part of a person's soul to go there. So anyway, that really, if you get down to what these veterans, when you ask them what were they doing and what was it like, that's what they'll tell you.
Let's talk a bit more about Stan Parker. you met Stan Parker in Afghanistan in 2005, 45 years after, or 30-some years after this battle. He was still in the military then,
right.
37 years later. And he basically pitches his story to you about his time in Vietnam and asked you to write about him. What were your initial impressions when you met him?
I said, who's that old soldier walking around the Bagram Air Base loading helicopters, these big Chinook helicopters? This is 2005. I've been working on this book for more than 10 years in some way. And I was trying to go to a special forces camp on the Pakistani border. I was researching horse soldiers. It was raining, and we got up, and then we had to come back down. We got up, and there was Stan Parker in the back of the helicopter. He had his full kit on. He looked like a very serious soldier, but yet he was the oldest guy on the strip. And finally he said, did you write In Harm's Way? And I said, yes, I did. He said, well, I read it. And out of the blue, he said, would you ever write about Vietnam? And I said, Stan, I'm in the middle of writing about Afghanistan. We're fighting, and we're already fighting in two places. War is everywhere. I just don't think America wants to hear it. And I don't know if you guys are really ready to talk. In 2011, I spoke at the Air Force Academy and addressed the cadets and some officers, and he lived in Colorado Springs. We met at his kitchen table, and he began to roll out the story, much as I just read to you. He saw it as a survival story. You're really reading about people here. I mean, my job in some ways is to make you forget that it's about war. And that may sound funny, but I want you to figure out how you're more like these guys than you dislike them, because the disassociation and the less we understand about the costs of these wars and what it means to have gone there, the worse off we are. So he pestered me. He didn't pester me, but we kept up a correspondence, and finally I commenced the book. And ended up going back to Vietnam with him in 2014.
What are some of the obstacles to connecting with these soldiers? Or at least, what are some of the obstacles you found as a writer when trying to write something that would connect with readers?
You have to understand that we're talking about this book right now. I don't know how many conversations have taken place on radio or television in the last 10 years that have to do with Vietnam. You could probably count them on all fingers and toes. I mean, we're really hopefully, with the emergence of the Ken Burns documentary coming out and a lot of 50th anniversary acknowledgments around the Vietnam War, we're in new territory here. So the obstacle is they've never talked about it. I mean, The veterans. When I was doing book signings for horse soldiers, I would often sign a book for a person, a woman, and she would say, who's this for? And I'd say, for my husband. I'd say, well, where is he? Well, he's over there in the corner of the bookstore. I'd say, well, have him come on over. Was he in the service? Yes, he was. He was in Vietnam. And I said, okay, well, no, he doesn't want to come over. I mean, when you realize that, you got to really, that for us as a society, that's not healthy. You know, that's dysfunction. And one of the things I hope this book does is I think it's a quick read. I think it's compelling, and I hope that it provides these opportunities, these moments where people can talk within their own families and communities about maybe what someone did in Vietnam. I found that to be true with In Harm's Way, that book opened up a lot of discussion within families. You don't have to know a lot of politics to read this book, and you don't have to like the army. You don't have to like war, because it's not about war. This is a story about the journey that someone goes to when you put them in an existential situation where they have to make terribly difficult situations at the least opportune moment. And that's what war is. And in some ways, that's what life is. But war is that on steroids.
We're speaking with author Doug Stanton about his new book about the Vietnam War called The Odyssey of Echo Company. You can call in with your question or comment at 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. We had a question earlier about historical research about what went into writing this book, it reads almost like you were there with them experiencing mm-hmm. this. How did you recreate these stories?
Well, I wrote magazine pieces for 10 years, and I basically move in with people. Like, I ask them to write down their dreams, what they had, what their grocery lists. I'm a very obsessive reporter. I interview and interview and interview. And Stan Parker is a brave person for a couple of reasons. One, he survived all this and came home and is a loving person. But two, for him to approach me, just imagine any of us approaching a stranger in a helicopter and say, would you write about the most intimate, painful memory I have? I mean, that takes a certain amount of desperation and a certain amount of bravery as well. So how did I get so close? I got so close because Stan was willing bravely to let the chips fall where they may. And so he would provide monographs and diaries and letters that he wrote from the field. And
so he had a paper trail as well.
Yes. So Stan Parker ends up, the reason I meet him in Afghanistan is he becomes a sergeant major in Special Operations Command, which is out of MacDill, Tampa, Florida. He ends up very senior in the military. And as sergeant major, you're an astounding record keeper. And it just comes naturally to you. And he had journals and monographs that he'd written shortly after he came home that were invaluable. And then by merging those with after-action reports, by then we gathered twice in California with other members of the platoon and had a week or so of interviews with other guys as well. So it comes together out of this mix of voices, history, facts, and memories.
What were those experiences like when the platoon met up?
They hadn't met before. I mean, we met with Tim Anderson, who lives in the Pacific Northwest. He came to Stan Parker's house in Colorado Springs, and I watched them kind of embrace for the first time in years and sit down. And it was Tim Anderson who said to me, you know, Doug, that year was the most important year of my life, and I don't remember any of it. I came home. My parents had a party for me, homecoming party. It was snowing. My buddy said, as soon as it stops snowing, we're going to get in this old renovated mail van. We're going to move to California and live on the beach for 2 years. And he said, I did. And he ended up running a construction company and going on with his life. But Tim can't remember what happened to him there. So what he would do is listen to the other guys, and then things would come back to him. Other guys disagreed about accounts of events. There was a lot of tears. We sat on the street corner in Saigon after touring the battlefield, and I was with Tom Soles, another platoon mate of Stan Parker's, and Tom and Ann Stanton and I, and it was a hot night and with a bucket of ice filled with beer, and there were a lot of tears, you know, as they talked about what they'd seen that day.
The battles are chaotic moments, and we're talking about battles that happened 40 some years ago now. Was it difficult to piece together the events? Was it difficult to come up with the story, the actual sequence, what happened when you're dealing with?
No, because the movements are recorded in after action reports. And so the question is then, so my question is, how did you survive this and how did it make you feel? Like, we can find out what happened, but what did you do? What was that like? What did you do next? What did you eat that day? Where did you guys sleep? What color was the can of peaches that you gave the little girl in the middle of the road? If you really think about it, you can ask almost any question. And if you keep drilling, I did this with horse soldiers too. you know, this a story will emerge.
We'd love to hear your question or your comment. The phone number is 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. Was Stan aware that he was unique in talking about his experiences?
Yes, yes, because while Stan Parker is a unique person in that he has lived a fascinating life, it's almost like a Zelig-like figure. He has been in a lot of places and lived in a lot of places, and he, for instance, if Tim Anderson had approached me in the helicopter, this would have been a much harder book to write. You know, my job, I think, as a writer is to be a witness. When he approached me, I said, I have to file this, your idea, under later. I don't think my agent is able to sell it, and I don't think American Publishing wants to publish it. It's astounding right now that this fall we're having this renaissance of Vietnam. I think it's a great thing. But I told Stan that back in 05 and again in 07 that I just didn't think that this book would fly. The main question, David, is how do you talk about Vietnam? Mostly we say things like, this is how I feel about Vietnam. I feel all the things that we already know, which is that it was an incredibly divisive moment in American politics. Nobody had a good time. When I was working on this book, I talked to William Hosner, a friend of ours, a pastel painter. I didn't know Bill had any thoughts about Vietnam at all until one day I started talking about the book, and we talked for an hour because he didn't go to the war, but his passion, the depth of that moment in American history had kind of ingrained itself in his character was just as strong as when Stan Parker was talking to me. And this is why I think it's so important to have this inflection moment in the society, because everyone was in Vietnam. I wasn't. I was too young. But we were all there, as Michael Hare says in Dispatches, one way or another. Either you fought there or you didn't fight there, but it was still the thing that everyone had to deal with. And it's at that moment, I think, in American politics that we see the cleaving between the right and the left kind of commence as well. And I think that's also a sign of our dysfunction.
What did you think about the war? What were some of your ideas about it and coming into writing this book?
Well, I partly wrote the book because I didn't know much about the war. I was too young. I just remember vaguely a body count at the bottom of the television screen when Walter Cronkite was doing his report. Today in Vietnam, 17 more American soldiers were killed. That just seemed normal to me after a while. Now when I think back on it, it's odd television. And so I wanted to know really what had been going on in the American, in the households, the families that I knew up and down Wood Street in Traverse City, Michigan during that era, who seemed so fractured, who seemed to be fighting about this all the time. And I wanted to know about the Vietnam veteran. I wanted to know about the guy in the bookstore who wouldn't come over and talk to me. There's a story there. And that's what I wanted to tell.
We're going to take a call. Pepper from Frankfurt. Pepper, you're on the air.
Okay, Doc.
Yes.
I am a doctor. I am a surgeon, but I was in Vietnam a little bit after the Tet Offensive. And I know that how horrendous was and how the brass and General Westmoreland and all those SOBs, they were telling completely the wrong story. They were telling us we were winning the war and we were losing the war. And of course, this,
Pepper, are you still there?
So
what did Stan think about that? Did they right. know? How did they think the war was going?
They thought that they were winning. I mean, so when I talked to Michael Bradshaw and Paul Sedano and other members of the platoon, I said, so what did you think of when in March, I believe, of 68, Walter Cronkite came actually to near where they were fighting and went back and made his famous broadcast.
An editorial.
Right. really a fascinating moment in news. They said, well, we thought we were winning, because the reality was, tactically, they were winning these battles. They would engage these fighters, and while the casualties were huge on the American side, they were typically beating up on the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese army. But what was the end point? You know, that, I mean, that's, and they never really got to that. That what the end point for these guys, unlike World War II, was let's make it out for the year. Let's get out of this hitch alive, and then we're going back to the States. I've got 3 more years in the army to serve, but I've done my my battle tour. You know, in World War II, the guys trained together, they deployed together, and they served together for a longer period of time. There was a much bigger sense of unit cohesion. So that a big part of this book, the reason it's called The Odyssey of Echo Company, the big part of this book is Stan Parker's homecoming. And the homecoming for, I think, a lot of veterans, not just Vietnam veterans, but those guys we see coming home today. And I want, and women, too.
Let's talk about that, but let's take a call. Take a call first. Let's talk to Kim in Seattle. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Doug for writing this book. I think he's correct about needing to address the Vietnam War and the effects of, because in my life, when I see the World War II vets get very emotional when they're thanked by somebody who's wearing a Vietnam War hat or jacket, it's because they then express to them, you guys gave a name to what we've been suffering with, which is PTSD. And Doug does a great job of describing that. I just wanted to thank him so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Kim.
Thanks for your call, Kim. Nearly 17,000 Americans died in Vietnam in 1968, in the year of the Tet Offensive, the bloodiest year of the war for the Americans. About 58,000 died in the war total, Americans. About 200,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong soldiers died during the fighting of 1968. You said it before, it was a military loss on paper, but yet that's not how it's remembered in the United States. It's not remembered as a strategic victory for the United States, but it's seen as this tipping point or some kind of turning point. Do you think that's an accurate description of what the Tet Offensive meant for the United States in the Vietnam War, that it was this turning point of public perception?
I do think it was a turning point of public perception, because what leadership failed to do is articulate, I think, an end strategy. Where are we headed? If we step back for a moment, what we can say to everyone is that we're fighting the Cold War. So this is actually a Cold War battle. By proxy, we're fighting Soviet influence in that part of the world. And if you forget that, you think, well, it doesn't make it any more sane, but it actually provides a geopolitical explanation for why President Johnson and Kennedy would want to project power in that part of the world, because they felt that they wanted to fight communist incursion. Now, that's what they thought. So the Vietnamese felt they were fighting a civil war. First, they had been occupied by others, then by the French, by the Japanese. The Americans are just one more...
very long war.
Yeah, one more ant on their back, which they have to slough off. They're fighting a battle of unification for the country between the North and the South. And I think in that way, we misread the situation.
We're speaking with author Doug Stanton about his new book about the Vietnam War called The Odyssey of Echo Company. It goes on sale September 19th. He'll be on the National Writer Series on September 17th. And you can call in with your question or your comment at 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. We've talked about this a bit, but the book is about more than Stan Parker and his platoon's time in Vietnam. It's about this process of coming home. Mm-hmm. What were the challenges for these men when they left the war in those early years?
Well, there were myriad. I mean, not everyone had a bad time. I know my friend Tim Keenan, also an author of his own book about his travails in Vietnam, had actually a wonderful homecoming. So I don't want to paint that this with a broad brush, but typically, when you hear that story at a dinner party or at the bar, oh yeah, these guys came home and somebody spit on them. Mm-hmm. It's typically true, but it often did not happen. And these guys in particular weren't spit on, but for instance, Stan Parker returns from his tour. He's wounded three times, and basically the book follows. It's kind of, I'm hoping the prose is kind of like a needle on the seismographic paper, kind of watching Stan experience this and come through it. And now he's got to come home to Gary, Indiana. What's he going to do next? As he's flying home, the civilian person, a woman next to the seat, rings the bell and the steward comes by and says, please, I'd like another seat, please. And the steward says, yes, I know we were trying to put you where you wouldn't have to sit next to this fellow. And he looks in the reflection in the window and says, what am I, a killer? Do I look crazy? He's sunburned. He has a haircut. But his senses are so attuned, this hyper-alertness that he's been living under.
What was going on there? How do you explain that encounter?
I'll explain it this way. By later in the airport in San Francisco, he's being hassled by some guys his own age, but they're wearing bandanas and they have longer hair than he does. And they're saying things like, hey, did you kill any babies over there, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those old things. And finally, Stan says, I can't take this anymore. If you keep talking, we're going to get in a fight. And this businessman next to him puts down his paper and says to the kid who's hassling Stan, hey, knock it off. And Stan says, thank you, sir. And then the businessman looks at him and says, well, I don't support you or the war either, but I didn't think what they were doing was right to you. It's because the war was so divisive. We had so many demonstrations in the U.S. So much civil unrest was going on here that it just – these guys get – they're kind of rolled up with the entire bad juju of the whole thing. And nobody wants to really talk about it, and they don't want to say anything either. Stan goes out and he begins to create another identity for himself at a bar when he tries to meet young women. You know, he pretends he's a college student, and then pretty soon they figure out that he's just lying to him because he can't really explain what college he goes to. I mean, it is a very humiliating experience.
I'd like to read to hear another passage from the book. It's from page 204, and it's from the description of the death of one of someone from the platoon, a man named Charlie Pyle, and another platoon mate named Dwight Lane, is crawling up to Charlie after he's shot in this firefight and watches him die. Could you read that mm-hmm. passage for us?
Sure. Charlie Pyle was a blonde, blue-eyed. Everyone liked Charlie. He was always he was just that kind of person. And so his death in the book and in the battle, often things were marked with this happened after Charlie Pyle died, or this happened before Charlie Pyle died. So this is Dwight Lane from Indiana as well, crawling up to his good buddy. Dwight Lane is about 20 feet away when Charlie drops, and he crawls up first just in time to watch him die. Charlie's blue eyes are still open. Dwight can't stand this, and he reaches over and tries closing them with his fingertips. He can't make them close. He thinks of all the movies he saw as a kid when the gunfighter reached over and did this for his newly dead buddy. Dwight thinks, this don't work like it does in the movies. He won't remember later how long he sat there with Charlie, hours or minutes, time had stopped. When he removes his hand and looks at Charlie's face again, he begins to cry, and in doing so, he dooms himself to a life of remembering. He hears somebody yelling, it's Warren Jewell, and he's yelling that he's hit and needs help. Dwight starts crawling on his belly toward his screaming friend.
That line about Dwight dooming himself to a life of remembering, you write about that idea several times in the book that I picked up on.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I mean, you know, I've written three books about war. I've never been in the military. And it's not that I like war. But when my friend Elmore Leonard, before he passed away, you know, no one ever asked Elmore if he liked crime just because he wrote crime novels all the time. I think I'm drawn to it because it provides these insights into the human nature. you know, about the both the best of us and the worst of us, and also have a heightened sense of mortality. And so I think, David, throughout this book, the book ends with the question, who's watching? Stan Parker, in that invocation I read, he's wondering, who's watching me? And the book ends with that very same question. And throughout the whole book, I was very careful to remind the reader that the question that's always being asked in anything we do is, who's watching and who are we watching and who are we taking care of? And if we don't remember these things, who's going to remember them for us? I mean, if we don't remember each other, do we exist? And if this is an unspoken American narrative, which I think it is in a Jungian sense, that it's that if you go to the Holiday Inn buffet this weekend and look at any 68-year-old man, he's going to be thinking about Vietnam. He may be in a suit, he may be in flip-flops, but that experience is embedded in his psyche. And for it to be buried there and unspoken is a tragedy. So throughout the book is really about remembering. And Stan Parker came to me and said, I won't be a better person for working with you on this book. I'm not going to be maybe different, but I might be more of who I am. And that, to me, really is the artist's job, to get down there and to create complexity. I'm not answering a lot of questions in this book. I'm trying to pose a lot of questions. And that question is, how does this make you feel? And what are you going to do now about it?
Doug Stanton's new book is called The Odyssey of Echo Company. And you're listening to a live call-in program with Doug on IPR News Radio. You can call in with your question or comment, 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. Let's take a call from Mike in Kingsley. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm just listening to the program. I'm glad you're covering the topic. It's still very timely. I'm 68 years old, as the person referred to. I did not serve in the military. However, it definitely was a watershed part of all of those who of us who lived at that time. Just attended a 50-year high school class reunion, and someone got up and made a pretty long, heart-rending speech about his experiences in Vietnam. So you can't look at the tone of the country without really going back to Vietnam as the kind of start of the political situation we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your call, Mike. Without giving too much of the book away, I wanted to talk about a trip that you took to Vietnam with Stan, with some other people, doing research for this book. What was that experience like?
It was amazing. If Vietnam weren't so far away, we'd all be there. Because what I'm feeling is that there are more veterans returning there, and the great irony of our discovery, of Stan Parker's discovery and his platoon mate Tom Soles, Tom flew with us and Ann Stanton was there, was that the former enemy and the American veteran have forgiven each other. And we haven't done that here in the States. They've moved on. In fact, I mean, to make a sweeping generalization about our experience with meeting with Vietnamese people is that they cared very little that these guys were Americans walking around and probably had fought, looked like their Vietnam vintage. The economy is doing well. Bill Clinton was a good guy because he opened up relations. You can get on Facebook and be censored only half the time. And when we talked to younger people on the street, they were all thinking about the future. So if they've moved on and the veterans are trying to move on, then I'm hopeful that the book in some ways, just as that last caller said, allows an insight for our own. We just want to pause a moment. We don't have to stand there a long time and stare at this moment, but we just have to pause for a moment because what we have, David, are generations of young men and women coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and this kind of story is not going to end. So going there was, without giving too much away about the end of the book, let me just put it this way. Stan Parker said, I've had more fun here, fun in quotes, but meaningful quotes, than I ever had coming back to the United States.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Jack Siegel from Traverse City. Jack, you're on the air.
Thank you. And thank you to Doug for writing this extremely important book at this time. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I always would ask myself, what am I trying to do here? And I wonder if Doug could link that, as he just began to do, to the soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who are now, again, facing this question. I don't really see what the strategic purpose is. So why am I here and why am I fighting these people?
Thanks, Jack.
That is the big question, Jack. I went to Jack with Afghanistan, actually. He poses the... Maybe we'll, before we go, I'll read a section that might help answer this. But my only answer right now is I don't know what to tell them except by telling them a story. But that doesn't answer any geopolitical need that we have to make sense of these wars. But I think there are two parts to any war. There's the political end, and then there's the spiritual or emotional end. And we are back in Afghanistan right now. And Jack raises the question, what are we going to tell the families in another 5 years of fighting that they died for over there if we don't have a real end, a light at the end of that tunnel? Here's the funny irony. Has Afghanistan become the next Vietnam? And I'm not sure how to write that essay or that editorial just yet.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Pat in Leelanau County. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, Doug. It's honored to be able to talk to you and listen to your perspective on Vietnam. I, too, am a 68-year-old who was not in Vietnam, but my very best friend did three tours there, and I picked him up from the airport. I can't remember the exact date, and he described to me the beauty of blowing off a Viet Cong's head, and I was just horrified.
Mm-hmm.
And then I continued to have a relationship with this person, and I'm going to highly recommend the book because the spiritual impact, the emotional impact, his mental stability, all that have been just greatly impacted. And I'm really looking forward to reading your book and listening to your perspective on it.
The only thing you can do, Pat, is just when someone, the only thing you can do is listen. You know,
you can't,
that's not a problem you can solve.
Oh, yeah.
But
I found that out.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you again.
Okay.
Bye.
Stan Parker went on to a long career in the Army. And yet Vietnam stood out for him. He said it was the scariest time in his career. What does this experience, the Tet Offensive, mean for people like Stan Parker today, 50 years later?
The fear of all of these troops was to have enemy soldiers kind of pierce the wire and come into the camp. And so you had this at large during the Tet. So that in itself is just frightening. But he happened to be in lots of hand-to-hand combat and was, as I say, wounded three times. What it meant was that this was not his father's war. And now he suddenly has to figure it out and just try to stay alive. It really... you know, some of the guys, one guy in the platoon is a wonderful fellow, but he still doesn't sleep in a bed. And, you know, this is what was so fascinating. I mean, if you start to talk to somebody we're going into the fall season and we get together as a family, just probe a little bit. You'll find out that your uncle actually gets up every night at 2 o'clock and walks the perimeter of the house. Because that's what he did in Vietnam. And he doesn't feel great about that. And it affects him probably the rest of his day. And then it affects the way he relates to you and his family and his job and his boss. And but when you dig a little deep, Vietnam is not far below the surface.
Let's take one more call. Let's go to Sheila in Frankfurt. Sheila, you're on the air.
Okay. Hi, Doug. Thank you very much for writing that book. And I'm anxiously looking forward to reading it because people don't talk about Vietnam. My husband and I got married in 67, and he didn't want to get drafted, so he joined the Air Force. And because all of our friends and family were anti-war, but he felt he had a duty to do this. And he didn't know where he was going to go, but knew for sure that it would probably be Vietnam. And when he found out what his orders were after some basic training, it's hard to believe, but everybody in his group went to Vietnam. And when they came to him, they said, "You're going to England." And so we were newlyweds, got married, went to England. And so our experience with the Vietnam War was entirely so opposite. But I just think it was meant to be that he didn't go to Vietnam, because I can't imagine him having to hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. So it's still painful for him. It really is. And maybe I've said this already, but not one person ever said to him, "Thank you for your service to the country."
Right.
So it's so different from Afghanistan and Iraq and World War II. So it's a difficult thing, and I think you're right. We do need to talk about this and get some of these feelings out, because they keep festering.
Right. They're a drag on our national economy.
Thanks for your call, Sheila.
Oh, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
This one last question. We're almost mm-hmm. up.
Yeah.
This book was a long project for you. What are you going to do next?
I'm going to write some television and some movies. I'm looking forward to the release of Horse Soldiers as a movie with Chris Hemsworth and Michael Shannon in January. And I'd like to start a new book sometime this spring. But I'll probably be hopefully going back and forth between Traverse City and Los Angeles, where it's a bit warmer. The books are, I wrote this in coffee shops in Traverse City. There are long hauls, and I'm looking forward to some collaborative work.
Our time is just about up, unfortunately. Doug Stanton's new book, called The Odyssey of Echo Company, is on sale September 19th from Scribner. He'll be a guest on the National Writer Series on September 17th. Doug, it was great to have you on.
Thank you.
You're listening to IPR News Radio, WICA, Traverse City, 91.5 FM, WLMN, Manistee, Ludington, 89.7 FM, WHBP, Harbor Springs, Petoskey, 90.1 FM. Online at iprnews.org. Science Friday is next. Have a nice weekend. It's 2 o'clock.